I found a report card from kindergarten and it said, immature, talks too much. And I was like, well, of course I talk too much. And why didn't she tell me that was the reason she kept moving me in the hall? I thought, and friends laugh at this, but it's true. I thought she was moving my seat because she wanted me to get to know everybody in the room. So I thought, oh, this is what we're doing. We're moving around the room to get to know everybody.
Hello and welcome to the Women and ADHD podcast. I'm your host, Katie Weber. I was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 45, and it completely turned my world upside down. I've been looking back at so much of my life, school, jobs, my relationships, all of it with this new lens, and it has been nothing short of overwhelming. I quickly discovered I was not the only woman to have this experience, and now I interview other women who, like me, discovered in adulthood they have ADHD and are finally feeling like they understand who they are and how to best lean into their strengths, both professionally and personally. Hello and welcome. We are going to jump right in, right away, with episode 180, in which I interview Robin Tate. Robin is an experienced teacher and a professional coach. She has a Master's of Science degree in reading and a Master's of Arts degree in counseling. She is trained through the Asperger Autism Network, AANE, as an Asper coach, as well as a neurodiverse couples coach. As a leader in the neurodiversity arena, Robin is setting a new standard for how to think about life through a neurological lens. She is committed to helping clients grow and create change in their lives by focusing on their strengths, overcoming challenges, and reaching their goals. Robin also enjoys spending time with her family, growing in her faith, and traveling. Robin and I talk about her diagnosis 20 years ago at the age of 30, and how her perspective about her own brain has changed over the years since then. We also talk about giftedness, masking, and the importance of educating all kids about executive functioning as early as possible. And we talk about neurodiverse couples coaching and how it differs from couples therapy, as well as some of the specific issues that might come up for couples when one or both partners is neurodivergent, especially when it comes to communication and goals. Okay, without further ado, here is my interview with Robin. Okay, before we get started with today's episode, have you heard the awesome news? Llama Life now has an iOS app so you can take it with you wherever you go. I have been using Llama Life consistently on my computer for a year now. A year! That's unprecedented. That's like a lifetime in ADHD terms. And now with the new iOS app, I'm able to seamlessly transition between my computer and my iPhone so that my favorite little productivity coach is with me whenever I need it. So what is so special about Llama Life? Well, for starters, it's not a fancy new calendar or planner or complicated productivity management system. It's a time-boxing, single-tasking program that easily integrates with your already existing organizational systems. If you're like me and you struggle with time blindness or maintaining focus throughout your day, then this is the app for you. I love Llama Life because it's simple, effective, and beautifully designed. And dare I say, it makes even the most mundane chore more fun and colorful. If you want to check out the iOS app for yourself, head to the App Store for a free trial and start enjoying that Llama Life for yourself. Hello, Robin. Thank you for joining me. Welcome to the Women in ADHD podcast.
Hi, Katie.
Let's start. You were diagnosed 20 years ago. Is that correct?
Yeah, 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's always amazing to me because I feel like the climate, the landscape around neurodivergence has changed so much in such a short period of time. So I'm curious, in terms of your own understanding about ADHD, what was happening? What kind of led to the diagnosis in the first place? What were those things that really led you to put two and two together for yourself and say, I really should look into this?
Yeah. It's really, really cool to turn 50 because I'm like looking backwards at these things. I think it's a natural process, at least talking to other friends that they're doing that. But for me, one of those things is that reality of like, when did I start to realize I had ADHD? What did this look like? And I just love every single woman that's been on your podcast that I've heard. It feels like you make a new friend and I want to call her and ask her this question. But I always knew I was different. So that makes it hard to find a start point, right? I have kindergarten stories, I have college stories, I have high school stories, but I really specifically remembering I was going through a lot of mental health challenges in my early 20s, figured out there was help for that, you know, and was working towards that. And a therapist saying to me, almost just like planting the seed that I completely ignored in my early 20s, you know, I think you have ADHD. And I was like, what is this? You know, it's so funny to think I didn't have a clue in the world what that was. It sounded like this huge pathological term, like, I don't want to have that, whatever it is, I'm sure it doesn't apply to me. And then just fast forward to a couple years later, not many, I'm 30 and married, having lots of unexpected challenges that I didn't understand. You know, I blamed him, all of us should, right? It was purely him. But then I'm in this master's program for reading, to learn how to teach reading. And I'm working as a teacher of the deaf. So I'm in special education. And I guess the year then is like 2002. And there's this phrase that's talking about associative thinking as being atypical. And it's describing it against linear thinking, which is typical. And it describes associative thinking as something like, you think you talk about an apple that's red, and all of a sudden you're talking about the red car that drove down the road. And wait, how fast was that car? I bet I could go faster than you can in my, right? And I'm reading that. And I was always challenged with reading growing up. So, you know, college level reading, it would not be uncommon to read something twice. But I mean, I read this 4 or 5 times, and it wasn't because I couldn't read it. It was because, I mean, what's wrong with associative thinking? And then just magically this light bulb goes off and I'm like, oh, you know, that's how I think. That's why this doesn't seem, you know, atypical to me. I listened to Sari Sulden on your podcast and I'm just like, oh my gosh, she has no idea. In 2002, that was like my person, right? And then Catherine Nadeo and Driven to Distraction, Hellwell. And I just remember those being, you know, there weren't really podcasts or anything but books. So I was just buying books to understand and conceptualize my own life. So I think it was just a matter of that. And then looking through my family history, and I just kept becoming increasingly, you know, I just was like, this is me. This all makes sense. It was giving context to my life. It was exciting, as opposed to what I thought the first time somebody said ADHD. It was like, oh, relief. This is just my brain. This is how it works. And then I think it was just, I'm a very bottom-up thinker. Like, I need all the details before you could convince me, and they all need to line up. So the next thing was I needed formal diagnosis. Now I'm meeting lots of adults that don't feel that they need the like stamp of approval. But then I really, really needed that. And I got really lucky that I called a place covered by my insurance. I said, I really need a thorough assessment. I knew women were, even at that point, not as diagnosed as men. And I need somebody that really, really gets it. And I got a therapist that walked through. Now, they didn't look for any other, you know, now we think of neurodivergence so differently. So they didn't look for any other aspects of being neurodivergent. No learning disabilities. No, you know, do you fall into the autism spectrum in any way? But they thoroughly evaluated me for ADHD and then concluded I had above average intelligence. And also, I passed, so to speak, right?
I know, I always joke, I aced that test.
Yeah, nailed it.
Yeah. Interesting. So did you find there was pushback or stigma involved in the process of seeking the diagnosis?
Yeah, you know, and I was kind of walking through this morning, you know, our conversation and what that might look like. And for me, the one word that just kept coming up with was masking, and how interesting it is that I was diagnosed 20 years ago. Because, you know, there was this childhood of feeling rejected and confusion, and kind of, you know, I was raised at a time where it was very common to have authoritative parents, right? Like, just kind of get it together, girl. You got to do this. What's the message? What you can't? Too bad. Do it anyway. Figure it out. So there's just always that. And then there was the transition into being a young professional, able, by the grace of God and a whole lot of work, I had made it through undergrad, rather successfully, and then was at a master's level and fully employed, married. And I thought, especially working in special education, I was so naive. I thought, if I go to people now and tell them, because to me, it was so exciting and it made so much sense, they're going to like give me accommodations. They're going to embrace this. They know I'm not lazy, right? Like they've seen me perform. So they're certainly, when I say this is really hard, you know, why are we changing systems again? You know, because that was a whole thing. IEP writers were changing like every year, and it would take me so long to get a hold of, you know, what's the system that we're using to create these documents. And then it'd be like, I'm being dramatic, but maybe it was 2 years. And they're like, another training to do it again. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is killing me. And I remember two specific times saying to people, the one was a professor in my master's for reading. I said, so, and it takes such courage, like to say I have ADHD, right? So I had really thought it out. And I was like, I'm going to tell her I'm drowning. You know what I realized? I have ADHD. And she goes, I mean, so all of us have ADHD. And I go, no, I mean, like I have a diagnosis and it started like at birth and I have childhood memory. She's like, okay, well, all of us have ADHD. I was like, oh, okay, thanks, bye. And I remember walking back away just so small, like, oh, don't do that again. Don't tell people that again. And I think that it was minimized just by all the masking I had learned to do to make it look okay. And still, you know, there's some of that, but I don't know. It's not, I don't think that the climate is quite as harsh, or I've created a whole life that feels safe and warm based on who I am. So it's a lot easier, you know, to go out and be the change and be the safe person for somebody now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it's all of those things combined, right? Like, you know, one of the reasons why I asked that question, like looking back over your life, the signs were there all along. What did they look like? Because I think obviously it so much of our experience in childhood was being sent those messages of, I have to figure this out myself. I have to get it together, right? I have to do this. I have to work harder. And then really feeling like we're struggling against ourselves. So yeah, if a professor says we all have ADHD, that's just another way of saying, figure it out, get it together, join the club, right?
Oh, yeah.
As though there is, you know, it's your personal laziness or your, you know, inability that is keeping you from figuring out having, you know, where you have a genuine processing disorder. And so we're constantly questioning, is this something that's genuine or am I just trying to make excuses for myself? You know, and then those are those moments where I'm like, huh, I wonder why we're all so exhausted. And I wonder why we all get to, you know, diagnosed with depression and all of those things that so many of us have in common.
Well, yeah. And I remember trying again at my, so I have two masters, right? So I was like, I'll do this again. And the response was, well, when people are struggling, then we provide accommodations for people with ADHD. And I thought, and again, you know, you just take a deep breath and walk away because it's so vulnerable to ask in the first place, or even just open the door to the conversation. And inside, you know, ADHD people, I share this trait with many of being just, you know, so there's that part of me inside that's like, this is so wrong. And then the part of me that's like, listen, it may be wrong, but you're probably not going to impact this system today. So go write your paper and put your, you know, put your mind to something that you can change. I have a lot of colleagues that work in the college arena, work in businesses, trying to advocate for neurodiverse people and creating changes and accommodations. And I don't know, my last experience, I think, with a system that gave me a response was, you know, along those lines, everybody has ADHD, we'll help you once you're challenged or you're struggling. Meanwhile, you're struggling, right? Because staying up all night to do paperwork, that's not something everybody has to do. That's a unique, different experience. So,
yeah. And I think it also just, it forwards that narrative of, only ask for help if you are at your absolute wit's end, right? And you've exhausted all other avenues within yourself, then you can ask for help, as opposed to, well, no, accommodations are supposed to keep me from struggling, right? Yeah, I know, I'm facing that with my kids. And I'm so grateful for the amount of knowledge and advocacy I'm able to do on their behalf around ADHD and what it looks like in school, because, you know, oftentimes, and I've complained about this to anybody who will listen when it comes to my kids, because they do really, really, their grades are really, really high. That's not where they're struggling. And so oftentimes I met with in the 504 meetings, I've met with the teachers who are like, why are we here? Why are we even talking about accommodations? They're doing fine. And you only using their grades as a metric for how they're doing. I'm like, well, they're actually really, really struggling with anxiety and having a lot of emotional breakdowns. And they're sort of like, well, then they should see a therapist.
Yeah. And you're like, no, but you have them like the bulk of their day. I know, I have experience advocate. I don't provide advocacy services, but you know, when people know what you know, you walk into the arena sometimes with people. And I've advocated to small private schools and had that experience where, you know, when you talk about and know so much about ADHD and autism and right, and all these invisible giftedness challenges that exist, anxiety in kids is a huge one. And you walk into a space with educators to have the conversation, whether it's your child or it's someone else's, you care or you wouldn't show up to do it. And then you're almost like blindsided with the reality that they do not hear or see what you see. And the letters behind my name get me more of a voice than sometimes the parent sitting there who has way more knowledge of their kid and also maybe some other letters behind their name. But in this situation, you know, it's just kind of received like a head nod, a maybe, we hear you. And I think there's moments where you think like, oh, there's comprehension, and then there's no carry through. And it's this repeated cycle of, well, they're okay. Look, they're cute. I've heard that. Look how cute they are. And you're like, well, cute's not going to get us through life, right? I mean, not most of us.
So I'm curious, what are some of the things when you were diagnosed, what are some of those things that you looked back at maybe in childhood or even when you were in school where you think, oh, yes, of course, that was ADHD and nobody had any idea?
Well, oh, my gosh, from the ground up, I don't know if, you know, it's a vivid, I don't know if it's a gift or a curse. I have vivid, vivid memories of extreme sensory challenges, you know, like terrified that a spider that was outside was probably going to somehow find his way in and he would touch me. You know, that was the whole like, or my clothes. I remember thinking like the turtleneck was going to swallow me. It just felt like it was squeezing my head so tightly. And of course, my mother didn't know, like, why would we even pick that battle? Let's just move to the next shirt, right? So that could result in a lot of upset. And the same with food. I remember sitting at the kitchen table with the lights off because I couldn't swallow peas or I couldn't eat peas because they would like pop in my mouth, or green beans that came from a can. And the solution then was like, let's turn off the lights and make her sit there while everybody watches TV. And I remember thinking, all right, if I fill this glass with water, I can get them in there and then I could swallow them whole and they'll release me from the kitchen table, right? But it never taught me to deal with, you know, the textures. The next really big hallmark, and I think this is so important because I realized it happened to more people than just me. First, they allowed me to come to kindergarten, which was such a big deal because my birthday was like 3 days after the cutoff. And then after 2 weeks, for some reason I had no idea of, because I was so excited to be there, they said, no, you can't come back until next year. So I remember just shame setting in then that something was really wrong with me, but I didn't know what, and they wouldn't let me come back. And then the next year, I came back a little bit more scared to be there, but happy. And then I remember spending so much time in the hallway. Like, Robin, take your desk, put it in the hallway. At 30, when I really started to realize this was ADHD, I found a report card from kindergarten and it said, immature, talks too much. And I was like, well, of course I talk too much. And why didn't she tell me that was the reason she kept moving me in the hall? I thought, and friends laugh at this, but it's true. I thought she was moving my seat because she wanted me to get to know everybody in the room. So I thought, oh, this is what we're doing. We're moving around the room to get to know everybody. No. No, that's not what we were doing. So, you know, there's those. And then I have fast forward, you know, memories where I'm trying to think that there were some really, really good ones of, oh, being a teacher and having my first classroom and then having to orchestrate not just like the decorating of the room, but the students' IEPs, the students' needs, being on time. What do I wear? How do I uphold? Because it was like my first time doing life in an unstructured environment all by myself, right? Like, so how do I make sure I have food and clothes and all these things, needs met? Oh, and a teacher's assistant. So no instructions. Here's a person you get to boss around and have help you. Oh my gosh. Just so many funny stories there that I look back and I'm like, oh, that was so ADHD. But being late, you know, like being 5 minutes late on a regular basis that people could predict and almost getting it to a system that I was like 5 minutes late. But it was annoying to people. And I remember the eye rolls and the sighs and the, and I'm like, what? I'm doing my best. I'm doing my best. I don't think then I had the awareness that I could kind of do some things to trick myself into being on time. But yeah, embarrassment, I think that people saw things too that I didn't see. Oh, and the last one, I really have to share this, was getting out of high school with a C. And I can tell you this now because I have had 4.0 experiences, okay? Getting out of high school with a C average, realizing that my best writing was probably like a C or D. So I have no idea how they let me into a state school. I was just thrilled they did. And failing out to the point where they said, listen, if you take this study skills class and you get B's, we'll let you stay. And if you don't, you're going home. I think that was the first time I really, really realized, wow, there's something very different. But the study skills class changed my focus of my life and probably even drove my career now as to where it is, because it just laid this foundation of teaching me how to learn, giving me formatted, like, here, you need a planner. Guess what? In the study guide is everything you need to know for the test. And I remember those moments being like epiphanies to me. So I don't know. Those are a lot of moments over 50 years, but they stick with you, I think, on some level.
If you have ADHD, it can often feel overwhelming to find the right treatment. And then when you finally do get an appointment with your local clinician, there's no guarantee that they will have the adequate background or understanding of ADHD in adults, especially in women. You might end up leaving that appointment more confused and disheartened than when you entered. That's where Done comes in. Done is an online ADHD care platform that can get you all the resources you need to help manage your ADHD. With experienced clinicians who know exactly what to look for, you can start getting personalized care as soon as today or tomorrow. Take a free one-minute assessment and book an appointment with a licensed ADHD clinician as soon as the next day. Get continuous care, one-click refills, insurance coverage, and 24/7 care team support with Done for just $79 a month and pharmacy copays as low as $0. Visit get.donefirst.com/podcast to learn more. Again, that's get.donefirst.com/podcast. Done. Turn ADHD into your strength. That is amazing. You know, I've offhandedly, I have remarked on this podcast how I wish they taught executive functioning in school and not like cooking or, you know, home and home ec as like a sweeping term. And I actually had a really sweet home ec teacher email me once and say, you know, we actually do teach a lot of executive functioning in home ec. And I was like, I need to formally apologize for the record because I never took home ec, but I feel like if I could go back and do it all over again, like, especially knowing what I know now and being back in school and seeing how, gosh, it would have been so helpful to really understand executive functioning at a much younger age. And I had never even heard of the term as a, just a lay person. I had never even heard of the term until well after my diagnosis through research. But yeah.
You and I are on the same page with that. Why aren't we teaching it from the ground up? I mean, there's so many, every person, every human uses their executive functions. Most people have strengths somewhere and challenges someplace. And what would it be like if every course that a child had from even someplace in elementary or pre-K, wherever we could hit a developmental milestone that made sense, just start incorporating it with every lesson they have. Wouldn't that be magical? To the point where they start taking over their accommodations, you know, for themselves, because it's just built in. Because we know it's in writing, it's in reading, it's in math, but we're not there yet. I like the yet. We're not there yet.
So now, how did you transition from teaching to then working with adults and mostly coaching now, right?
Yeah. It's an interesting journey. So I had this awareness of ADHD and did the whole hyper-focus and learn about ADHD till I just couldn't anymore, right? Like I absorbed everything I could at that time. And then, you know, we planned, we were planners. So I had a child and we had decided, you know, I would stay home. Well, that in and of itself is a whole conversation. Being a mom, having ADHD, I always say like, okay, what they didn't tell me was everything I had to do for myself, which I was barely doing, I now I'm going to have to do for, you know, as many living people or animals, because we have pets, that I bring into this house. And maybe if they had said that rather than, oh, look, they're so cute. You know, I love my children, so please don't take this literally, right? But I might have been like, I don't know that I'm qualified to be a mom. This is a little big. But, you know, back to your question. So I'm a stay-at-home mom, which seemed like my ideal job. And I'm realizing like, wow, this is so hard. And also, as hard as it was, I needed something else also. That's a classic ADHD. I need my brain. There's another part of my brain that still needs stimulation. I think we share this quality that you're on this path right now, I think. But I'd always thought, oh, I'd love to be a social worker, counselor, therapist, you know. But I already had a master's in education. I had a solid career. I was tenured. You know, it wasn't logical. But I started kind of dreaming and I would look. So in the times like the kids were napping and I finally had things together, which were rare, I would dream. I would look online and I found a master's program in counseling and I thought, I'm going to take one class. So I delve into that and the reading, you know, at the same time, I had a cousin diagnosed with autism. You know, I came out of college in 1996 when Asperger's syndrome was in the DSM, I think 1994. So I was meeting all these little people with this new diagnosis and they look like these typical kids, except some social stuff that was awkward or little quirky things, I think at the time is what it felt like as a professional. So when my cousin got diagnosed, I just became as mesmerized with autism. And that lined up with when I was doing my master's and was really given a lot of freedom in terms of topic and, you know, like, here's the assignment, but your topic could be whatever. So I did a lot of studying around ADHD, autism, but in adults and marriages and relationships. And that became the connector, you know, of I had no idea where it was going to go. As a matter of fact, I still had moments where I was like, I'm never doing that. But yet I would write about it. I'm probably going to work with trauma, but I'm writing about autism and ADHD. And I graduated and I was like, I'm going to take some space and do life. You know, financially, we were able for me to do that. I had given away the career teaching position. So I was going to be with the kids still, even though they're in school at this point. But I'm going to get our house back in shape, kind of collect myself. And I started getting calls from people I went to school with that said, you know, I have this adult that has autism. I have this adult that has ADHD. I have this couple in a marriage. And I was spouting off for free all this information. And there was this sparkle inside, right? Like, oh, I want to do this. I want to do this. And a friend said, you know, would you please just go do it and stop giving it away for free? You're making me crazy. I can't even watch it anymore, right? Like, you obviously want to do this. And so the bridge into coaching was through an organization in New England called AA&E. They work with adults with what was called Asperger's, now Autism 1. And they had a coaching program. I thought, well, coaches just are people who want to be therapists, until I met them and I went through their training. And I was like, wow, no, this is a whole nother field that if done well and done ethically, which people are doing in all kinds of different ways because it's not regulated right now, but there's a value here. I knew that a lot of neurodivergent people had been unintentionally harmed in therapy. They'd go once and they were not going back. But when you say coach, and you're saying, I'm not going to diagnose you. There's no healing. I'm just coming alongside of you. And what's the problem you want to solve? Right? That's a whole different mindset. And for some people, not everyone, that's appropriate and it's safe, you know, and then you grow. So that was kind of my bridge into the coaching world. And that's exactly, I work with neurodiverse adults and couples. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like we do have so many parallels in terms of just the seeing and, you know, like you said, like the associative thinking about seeing some of the ways in which these like siloed approaches to mental health could really benefit from, you know, all of these different more holistic approaches, but at the same time also being like, I'm so fascinated. I like gathering different certifications here and there and just being lifelong learners, right? Being like, God, this is so interesting. I want to do this and I want to do this. And I feel like every day, you know, every day I'm like decidedly, you know, I'll go to the library and be like, I want to be a librarian. How do I, you know, and I want to own a coffee shop.
I want to be a librarian. Yes.
But also seeing, like you said, some of the real harm that is done in counseling just around, you know, what is believed to be maybe maladaptive thinking or, you know, some of the ways in which there's a real focus on behavioral change and not a lot of like, you know, work on understanding what's behind that. And yeah, it is really fascinating. And I think for me, I came at it as a coach realizing like, God, I would really benefit from like, I'll probably stay coaching, but I feel like I would really benefit from having the counseling background as well, to kind of because it feels like the two of them work really, really well together. And it just also seems like the in the curriculum of the counseling program I'm in, that there is a move, much more of a move toward stuff that I had already been taught as a coach, right? A lot of that, like you said, that now what? You know, that forward thinking and that forward movement. And so it does seem like it's almost being built into, like, you know, I had a professor who said, like, counseling is now what coaching was 10 years ago. Maybe. I feel like we're moving in that direction.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like I've been, so I graduated with my counseling degree in 2014. And so I really skipped, other than my internships, skipped working as a counselor. I had the opportunities, but decided I was going to go work for myself and jumped into the coaching lane. And again, hyper-focused on what do coaches do and really being ethical and staying in my lane. And I think especially because I have a therapy background, right? But therapists can coach. Coaches can't do therapy. And so that has always been my question. Will I go and actually use the therapy? So many people said, Robin, you have both. We need therapists too. And I'm like, yeah, but we need coaches. And my client list is full. So for right now, what I've done, and I love doing this, it's been such a great surprise in doing this work, is partnering with the therapists that my clients have and just having really great dialogue or consultations and saying, because fair, I only learned about neurodiversity because I pursued it. It wasn't in my counseling program. So I have that compassion that, you know, if there was harm, it was likely unintentional. It was like, I was never taught this. So how would I know to switch my lens and consider neurology before thinking about mental health, right? Like making sure, is this person on the spectrum? Does this person have ADHD? How are they looking at life? What is their perspective? So I get this gift of having like small little moments with therapists and say, well, look, this is what, can I tell you what you're describing right now in this couple, right? It's not just high conflict. It fits this pattern I see on a regular basis. If you thought about it like this, would that change how you think about it? You know, or have you read this book? That might help you. Or what about this skill? Or, you know, one I think that was key and I talk to people about a lot because I'll get feedback from a neurodivergent adult that's like getting told they're being passive aggressive because they aren't cooperating with the therapist. They didn't do the work and they failed therapy. And I'm like, okay, at the end of the session, did you know that there was homework? And the wife or husband who knows is like, yes, we did. And I'm like, wait, hold on. Did you know that there was homework? And they're like, no, like there was no idea that there was carryover or expectation sometimes. if there was awareness there, it was never made concrete. It wasn't where, when, why, how is this going to get happen? Do you see any obstacles that'll get in the way? And because, you know, one, therapy can be a really anxiety, so can coaching, anxiety producing activity for somebody who's, you know, working on change and doesn't really know the process and feels like they've messed up a lot. So their anxiety's high, their brain's already not functioning at full speed. And now we're not really making concrete our expectations that need to happen after therapy. That's one of the greatest connectors I can make. It's such a huge impact for both. I think the therapist and the client to realize like, oh, you're not being passive aggressive. You're not working against me. This is just like, you know, we can just make this concrete and be on the same page.
Yeah, that's such a great description of the way in which many times we need very explicit instructions and also an explicit kind of very structured understanding of what steps are. And it's one of the things that doesn't come naturally, I think, to a lot of us in our own lives, but also then in when it comes to what we need from instructions and even just learning. And I think why, you know, term like phrases like goals can be really loaded. You know, sometimes I'll see that like crush your goals with coaching. And I'm like, the first thing I do when I work with clients is like, what is your relationship with the word goals? Because oftentimes we don't meet our own goals and we have a really hard time even creating them anymore because we're so tired of disappointing ourselves. And so I'm like, let's even talk about that, just that word alone. And, you know, what kind of baggage does a client come into your relationship with in terms of, you know, where we failed in the past and not known why and been very confused about it and let down, et cetera, et cetera. So now you sort of answered this, but like, what is the main difference between couples therapy and couples coaching?
Oh, you know, I think the biggest is I'm not healing mental health challenges. And so that conversation comes up really fast in our, you know, first meeting or even like free 30-minute call to see if we're a good fit. And you and I know that there's a lot of co-occurring, you know, anxiety, depression, regulation challenges that can come with ADHD or autism. So I just walk into that. You know, it's not saying I'm not going to work with you, but coaching is really stressful. And so if you are working with a therapist to heal mental health challenges, then as a coach, I'm going to talk to your therapist and we're going to see, you know, what level is appropriate and good for you to not cause too much stress. And if you're not, but you have, and you're saying you're managing whatever anxiety, depression you have, or you've never had that, then we're going to work on building awareness and then moving forward to reach your goals, which is a lot of building up skills and really chunking down, finding out what the obstacles are and overcoming them, you know, and it's a lot of experiments to find out along the way, you know, what works for you and what doesn't work for you. And so it's, you know, I have this contract that asks people for a homework commitment, right? And if you're not doing your homework, then we're going to have a conversation. That's all it says. We're going to have a conversation. Some people are really nervous about that, right? Like they're like, well, what if I forget? I'm like, okay, so we're really talking about homework progress, right? Did you put forth your best attempt? And then when you come back, can we build the awareness as to why it went well, what didn't go well, or if you tackled it again, how would we go about this better? Do we need to break it down into smaller steps? Do we need to just talk about it? I love that you addressed the goal language. I might steal that. I don't think I've ever said it that blatantly. But do we just talk about it in a different way that helps you feel better? Or do we need to build comfort into whatever was happening, you know, so that it feels right? You know, there's more and more coming out that talks about that, the relationship of self-regulation connected with executive function and how big it is. You know, when you feel calm in the space, you can tackle things that you can't otherwise tackle. So just really jumping in and tackling that. So how does that differ from a therapist, right? We don't ever, like we go back in telling a story, but it's very purposeful if that's happening after the first session where we're really just getting to know each other as quickly as we can. It's, let me hear about, I'll give you an example. I worked with a guy who super smart and had gotten let go over COVID and just really wasn't sleeping, wasn't eating, really challenged with pulling his executive functions together to look for a job. And so I think mental health might have went back and looked at, are you depressed? Are you anxious? And he said, I'm not depressed or anxious. I've done this before. And I was like, I know you've done this before. So we went back to talk about, how did you do this before? And what went well, right? So we want to keep those parts that really went well. And then, you know, do any of those apply to where we are now, where you are now? And how do we push those things forward? So there's a lot more forward movement and less evaluation of, not to say we don't talk about how you feel, but evaluating, having your feelings be well, maybe is a good way to say it, in coaching, and a lot more doing.
Yeah. And I think also, like, once we can look at things a little more objectively, then, like you said, there's just as much valuable information from when you achieve something as when if you didn't achieve it, right? Because then we can look and say, okay, what do we need to do differently? What were the barriers? What stood in your way? So that's all really important information, as long as it's not laden with shame. So like, let's work on the shame and the mindset first, so that we can then really get productive about what works and what doesn't work. And I think in couples too, like, I know just my own history with my husband, so much of it was miscommunication in terms of how something was given versus how it was received. When one or both of the individuals, what's the word for one half of a couple? But like, if one or both are neurodivergent, I think there is a lot of that feeling like help can be seen as judgment, right? And I think that that was something, I know I remember talking to Casey Davis once about when I was a stay-at-home mother and my husband would come home and immediately when he walked through the door, he would start cleaning up. And I took that to mean he was upset at how messy the house was and he was disappointed in me and he was thought I was lazy and I wasn't doing anything. Like, I had this whole story about what that meant, as opposed to his story, which was, Katie's been working so hard. She's with a kid all day. And here I am. The first thing I want to do when I get home is help her and take the load off for her. Right. And so, but it was like two completely different stories. And, you know, a lot of the time it really is about just getting to those communication challenges and the communication differences.
Yeah. I love that example of you and your husband, because it's such a perspective taking difference. Right. But without somebody noticing that, you know, you're internally telling different stories or you're externally talking about the same event, but just from different angles, a couple can get really stuck there for a long, long time. And anger and resentment and negativity can really build up. So a lot of the couple's work, interesting, is the similar to working with an individual in that, right, it's communication, executive function, and self-regulation. A lot of the obstacles lie in one of those three areas for neurodivergent people and then couples. And when you think about a system, that's really what a family is. It's not much different of having yourself in space at work than it is at home, except for the expectation of how, you know, deeply you're known. You know, there's a little bit more, I'm going to use the word nakedness, but I mean emotional nakedness. There's that kind of nakedness too, but emotional nakedness and vulnerability. And so that person can become even more dangerous and scary to you, or you may take your internal thoughts and put it on them even faster because they're so close. And so really like digging in a way that, and I think lived experience, I don't know if you've had this experience, but I think lived experience as the professional is one of those connectors that creates the safety. And not to say neurotypicals can't work with neurodivergence. I don't mean that in any way. But when you can say, so I'm wondering if your partner's sitting in the car at the agreed upon time to leave, and are you gathering your things at that time, jumping in the shower, or contemplating how you're going to leave at that time? And are they angry? You know, they're like, are you at our house? Have you been here?
Hey, friend, if there's one thing I've learned about ADHD over the last few years is that we can thrive with the right combination of accountability, planning, coaching, and peer support. Knowing all this, I set out to create the ultimate all-in-one coaching and accountability community for adults with ADHD or learning disabilities. I knew I couldn't do it alone, so I joined forces with one of my favorite ADHD coaches, Alex Gilbert of Capable Consulting, and together we launched the ADHD Lounge. The Lounge was created as a safe place for neurodivergent adults away from other social media, where we offer live group calls, co-working, and body doubling every weekday for accountability, focus, and skill development. We have weekly and monthly goal planning sessions to keep yourself on track. We also have one-on-one office hours with myself and Alex, and of course, friendship and lots of peer support. We have three different membership levels to meet you where you're at. So if you're looking for an affordable way to stay connected, productive, and accountable, while also having regular access to ADHD coaching and expertise, then make sure to come join me in the ADHDLounge.com. Again, that's the ADHDLounge.com. And as a listener of the Women in ADHD podcast, you can get 30% off your first month with the code PODCAST30. So head to the ADHDLounge.com and use the code PODCAST30 to get 30% off your first month. During the early days of my diagnosis, as I was deep into hyper-focus ADHD research mode, I kept searching for some kind of all-in-one, everything you ever needed to know about ADHD and women handbook that I could reference and keep at my fingertips, but I never really found anything that suited me. That's why I've taken everything I've learned about ADHD in women and adults who are socialized as girls, and I've gathered it into a concise, easy-to-access, self-guided, and self-paced course so you can feel like you've got everything you need at your fingertips. It's called Hey, It's ADHD, and it has everything you need to start loving your brain and living a more fulfilling, gratifying life. I built this course to be helpful wherever you are on your ADHD journey. I am so excited to finally be able to offer this course, and I truly hope this will help you develop a deeper understanding of your ADHD brain and how to embrace it as you build yourself a toolkit for your own life. So head over to womenandadhd.com and click on the Hey, It's ADHD course tab for more information and to get started. So tell me about this. So Uniquely Us, this is a book that you participated in. It looks really, really interesting. Can you tell me a bit about it and kind of how you got involved?
Yeah. So, you know, there's so much to do when you own your own business now, and you can easily get are you writing? Are you creating content? Do you have courses? What do you? So right now I'm at the, you experience it.
I was just like, exhale. Yes. I think I know what you mean. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm so glad. Cause you look, so, you know, everybody looks so good on their website or on their podcast. So to hear you say that or have that reaction is very, very healthy for me. Because I think that's the place where I am. I really stepped into this arena to do one-to-one coaching and was been well received, you know, and more than I realized. I have a lot of imposter syndrome. So I'm like, wait, me? Really? Okay. And also just even if it feels horrible, even if it feels like they can't possibly be talking to me, I'm not going to miss an opportunity. So I'll step into it, you know, a little bit uncomfortable because I know I can't miss it. But what's happened is, you know, that question, I was sitting right at the cusp of it, really doing nothing. I mean, not doing nothing, but just coaching. And a colleague said, Dr. Stephanie Holmes said, and she has a podcast also, but she said, Robin, will you write this chapter in my book? And will you write it about executive function and the impact on neurodiverse couples? And I said, yes. But inside I was like, you know, massive panic attack because I haven't written in 10 years since I did my last master's degree. And as we pull each other up, because I think this is a field where that happens, you know, a lot. It's always been my experience so far anyway. I said, I'm not sure. And she said, yes, you can. You have 2 master's degrees. I know you can. And here's the deadline, right? So it was a great, great experience. It's really cool to find the space in my brain and pull my executive functions together to be able to dig into the research of what I was doing and even grow more and learn more. And so it's a nice little summary and a really beginning. So it's opened the door for me to continue with my own book, which I think is going to happen in the next year or so. But it just lays the foundation of the ways that executive function impacts neurodiverse relationships, which is so much more significant than I realized before I started working with couples. And then we end with some like case studies. So the purpose of her book, which is really cool, is it goes a little further than just let's talk about neurodiversity. Let's talk about neurodiversity in couples, which needs to be talked about, right? Like there's a huge market to be talking about that right now. But it also is addressing things that were happening in the church and the literalism that can happen in the church and the way that was impacting couples or is impacting couples. To start just kind of bringing a voice to some topics that people were feeling really isolated and alone in. And so I'm excited to be part of her team. She's pretty brave in her writing. And yeah, it's an exciting moment.
Yeah, I got a chance to look at a little bit of the blurbs before. I'm not sure. It's going to be a couple. I think this episode will be out before the book comes out, but I'll make sure to put a link so people can reserve a copy. It looks really great. And I think, like you said, especially for women, I think there are a lot of conflicting roles around domesticity and motherhood and being a good wife that conflict with neurodivergence in a lot of ways. And like you said, needing to operate on a higher frequency and needing to be busy. And, you know, I was like you, I worked with my first child and I was miserable and I couldn't handle it all. And I said to my husband, if we have another child, I have to be a stay-at-home mother. I cannot work. And so we did that. We left the city. We moved somewhere where we could afford so that it was just his income. And then I was a stay-at-home mom and I was like, oh, crap, this is worse.
Oh, we had the exact same experience. I wish we were neighbors.
I know, right? I was like, God, I'm so bored. I was just like, oh, I've made a terrible mistake. But again, I think it's really like, if only I understood back then really that I, first of all, was a great mom all the whole time. But really, like, what were the strengths of what did I need? And what were, you know, all of that, I think, is so important. And as women, I think there's just, you know, it's not something, there's so much stigma around being the best mother and being happy with your lot and being, you know, always delighted and always have an apple pie on the windowsill and all of that. And so I think there is so much sort of stigma and shame around any woman who secretly wants anything else. So yeah, it's incredible.
And well, and saying this is hard because we look forward to children for so long and then you're like, what? This is what it is. You know, it's almost taboo to, you know, to say that, but.
Mm-hmm. Well, or even to say it feels hard because I'm not doing it the way I need to be doing it. Right. As opposed to the fact that what we often say, which is I'm not trying hard enough, or I, you know, like you said, I have to get my act together and figure it out.
But it's a great lesson. You know, I think the thing is that the more I grow as a person, and I'm still on this journey, you know, I'm still in therapy, I'm still doing the whole thing. But to be able to give ourselves compassion first, right? Even our younger selves. So I like look back at the mom who didn't have the right outfit. You know how in elementary school they need the certain like special 100-day outfit. And you're like, oh, that's tomorrow and it's midnight. I don't know if you had that experience.
Oh, yes.
You know, but like going back and giving compassion and like remembering the things I had done well that day, even though that outfit didn't turn out nearly as cool as maybe 5 other kids in the class. There probably was another mom having the same experience I did, but I didn't know it at the time. I didn't experience that. And then really, I think in that process, I bring better compassion to myself now. And it's a cool way to be 50 to start looking back at the 30 somethings and going like, hey, I'm giving you compassion now. And I'm giving you compassion now. And I'm giving you compassion now because it's teaching a whole nother generation. I'll say I'm the first generation of aware of neurodivergence, right? Aware of my brain and how it works in my family. And so I think that's common. You know, many of us are the first generation. And so then to be able to now go, okay, we're going to be the first generation and we're also going to be feeding and nurturing the generation that's coming up behind us. That's a pretty cool way to be. At least that's how I'm getting through because I already turned 51, but it's a pretty cool way.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It is. And I think one of the things I am really, really grateful for with my diagnosis, even though I was 45 at the time, it's so radically transformed how I parent and how I view my parenting. And it's radically transformed just how I show up for my spouse. Like it's just, it has been really incredible to watch how, like you said, I'm able to just speak a different language with my kids in a way that I feel like is so empowering to them. And they love the fact that they have ADHD and they love being neurodivergent and they see all of the strengths about it. And Yeah, it is. It is really nice to be able to empower them in that way as a parent.
Yeah, it is. I just went to the ADHD conference in Baltimore, which was such a cool experience to be surrounded with all these other people that think like you and avoiding the over positivity, right? But it was a cool moment to just keep hearing people say, ADHD is my superpower. It might be my greatest challenge also, but it comes with a lot of really cool uniqueness that if you can embrace it and you can turn it into a life that feels right for you and be confident in what you are good at, then it's a cool place to be. And I see that difference. You know, we started this conversation saying like 20 years, you've got to know that you have ADHD. And I'm like, yeah, but 20 years ago, it was still a story that had a lot of shame. And now it's a story that's empowered, you know, where I'm like, but look, all these degrees turn into a career that works for my life, that empowers other people, you know, that gives me influence. And so it's a good story. I'm glad to hear your children are there now, because that means they won't be the 30-year-old who feels embarrassed to ask for what they need. And that's what I hope our story is, you know, by the time your children are teenagers. So like 15 years.
Yeah. Right. I hope so. But it's like you said, I think it really is. It's no coincidence that there has been this change over the last 20 years, thanks to Ned Halliwell and Sari Solden and Kathleen Nadeau and a lot of those pioneers who showed what it looked like to be an adult. Right. And I think, you know, it's probably no coincidence that this has changed. This mindset around ADHD has transformed alongside an increase in adult diagnoses and an increase in female diagnoses, you know, and I think that was just really well said about how our understanding has shifted to a sense of mindset and acceptance about this, what is wonderful and this gift, as opposed to looking at like, how are we going to fix it and how are we going to cure it and all of the ways that it used to be looked at. So. Ah, well, this has been wonderful. Thank you, Robin. I'm curious, do you have another name for ADHD, if you could go back and rename it?
Ooh, yeah. I really, if I could rename, and I think remembering I live in this land that merges ADHD and autism on a regular basis, I would just say, I would call it neurodivergence or neurodivergent, because there's so much, we're still looking at so much overlap. And so many, and then I think if I went even further, I would really love to see a world where we just start talking about humans in general and their strengths and challenges, because that would just even the playing field, right? And it would say like, what are you good at? What's hard for you? How do we come together as a team and move forward towards whatever goal it is, whether that would be professional, friendship, romantic. And I think that's naive. That's my naivety coming out. And if I had to do a rename, yeah, I think I'd go with neurodivergent.
Well, I love that too about, you know, eventually someday we'll just call it being human, because I think it comes back to the idea that you said earlier about like waiting and, you know, we don't get accommodations until we're really struggling. And if we could change that narrative and really treat each person as an individual and operate under that assumption of the fact that everybody wants to succeed. If you're not succeeding, what help do you need, right? It's not like you've just chosen to not show up, that like, you know, there's something that you need. And if we could look at every child that way, if we could look at every human that way, I think it would do us all a big service.
Yeah. Or, you know, the way you talk about executive function, you know, there's a lot of people I work with that do really, really well at whatever their chosen profession is, so much so they get promoted. And then comes a lot of space and skill expectation that isn't taught, right? And so if we had that mindset of strengths, challenges in every area of life, we go, okay, what are you good at in this position? And what could we teach you so that you can move into this position? How fast, you know, do you, or slow does that need to go for you? You know, what's the just right speed of that transition? How many of these skills can you take on? Because the people that I meet, that I work with, and I hope you can tell, I'm really fond of them as people and believers of them, are smart, are capable. They earned the position. But the fact that you're not taught how to make that transition or what is going to be expected, what are the social skills? What are the social expectations? What's the culture here? How am I supposed to schedule all these activities and also do the job I was doing before, you know, meetings, conferences, speaking events? So yeah, that's, again, I think I'm on my soapbox, but that's my naive hope and dream. If I could wave the magical wand, you know, out into the universe.
Well, even, you know, talk about the next generation too. Like, I feel like for so long, couples counseling, couples coaching, I'm sure also has a real stigma, right? Which is like, you don't go into couples counseling unless you're on the brink of divorce, unless you're in real trouble. When you're actually experiencing couples counseling, it's, couples counseling is for really, really strong relationships where people want to improve it, right? Like, there's a deep love and respect that it brings people to couples counseling. And I really, again, I feel like it's the younger generation, you know, I love hearing young people in their 20s who like aren't even married, but they and their boyfriend or girlfriend are like in couples counseling because it should go with the any relationship, right? I'm like, that, right? That should be like the wedding gift.
Yes, or before. I will tell you, I've had an interesting shift in clients and it's been so exciting. And really when I started, I would say, oh, it was average 10 years, a couple had been together, kids already, and there was distance and isolation and history, right, to overcome of miscommunications and misunderstanding. But really, in the last year and a half, I have a couple right now that isn't even married yet. They're getting married. So if you guys are listening, yay, congratulations. But they're getting married and they called me and said, hey, you know, we think one or each of us, you know, are neurodivergent. We don't even know, but we really want to nail this. Like, we want to get down. We would like you to teach us and coach us through what you think we need to know. And we do have a few areas, right, where we know we need some help. And they have been so exciting. And they're not the only ones. I've gotten a few that we've been married a month, right? We've been married a couple of years. So exciting, because we don't have to go back and undo. You know, there's not this need for as much forgiveness or as much hurt in each other's heart and, you know, building skills to have those conversations, which can be really much harder than talking about, let's have a planning meeting every week so that we know where each person is and we can count on each other. Let's talk about, when are we going to clean the house so that, for example, you aren't, you know, scurrying at the end of the day, you're feeling like a total failure because somebody, you know, your husband walks in and there's things laying around. You know, is that even an expectation? Is he even somebody that needs that done, or is he totally fine, you know, with the things laying around? Those are communication things that can cause a lot of problems over the years, and also hurt words said to each other, because we're really finding out too, a lot of response comes out of, you know, almost what they're labeling like a trauma reaction, right? Like a fight, flight, or freeze reaction that, oh my gosh, you're going to be angry at me. But you don't even know because you've never had this conversation with your partner in the first place. So exciting stuff to see younger people coming forward to ask for help before there is a problem and not having any stigma.
Right? Yeah. I'm like, all right, out for 2024 engagement rings in couples coaching.
There you go. Yes, yes, yes.
I'd much rather spend money on coaching than a diamond ring. So there we go.
Yeah. Don't take this the wrong way, guys, but here's some skill building. You're going to need it.
Right. Well, what a wonderful field. Really fascinating. Thank you for sharing a little bit about it. I'm really excited for you and for your clients too. And the Uniquely Us book, and got a lot of great stuff going on. So I'm so glad to have finally met you, and hopefully we can keep in touch.
Yeah. Thank you. And yeah, if anybody wants to reach out, my website is robintatellc.com. So that's probably the best way to reach me. And I'm hoping, you know, I'm excited. I told you, I'm in the state of overwhelm. Well, that usually kind of leads to some good next stuff. So I'm excited about some future writings, but I don't have dates or solid titles.
Well, excited. Well, I can't wait. Awesome. Well, thanks, Robin.
Thank you.
There you have it. Thank you for listening, and I really hope you enjoyed this episode of the Women and ADHD podcast. If you'd like to find out more about me and my coaching programs, head over to womenandadhd.com. If you're a woman who was diagnosed with ADHD and you'd like to apply to be a guest on this podcast, visit womenandadhd.com/podcastguest, and you can find that link in the episode show notes. Also, you know we ADHDers crave feedback, and I would really appreciate hearing from you, the listener. Please take a moment to leave me a review on Apple Podcasts or Audible. And if that feels like too much, and I totally get it, please just take a few seconds right now to give me a 5-star rating. Or share this episode on your own social media to help reach more women who maybe have yet to discover and lean into this gift of neurodivergency. And they may be struggling and they don't even know why. I'll see you next week when I interview another amazing woman who discovered she's not lazy or crazy or broken, but she has ADHD. And she's now on the path to understanding her neurodivergent mind and finally using this gift to her advantage. Take care till then. Okay, before we get started with today's episode, have you heard the awesome news? Llama Life now has an iOS app so you can take it with you wherever you go. I have been using Llama Life consistently on my computer for a year now. A year! That's unprecedented. That's like a lifetime in ADHD terms. And now with the new iOS app, I'm able to seamlessly transition between my computer and my iPhone so that my favorite little productivity coach is with me whenever I need it. So what is so special about Llama Life? Well, for starters, it's not a fancy new calendar or planner or complicated productivity management system. It's a time-boxing, single-tasking program that easily integrates with your already existing organizational systems. If you're like me and you struggle with time blindness or maintaining focus throughout your day, then this is the app for you. I love Llama Life because it's simple, effective, and beautifully designed. And dare I say, it makes even the most mundane chore more fun and colorful. If you want to check out the iOS app for yourself, head to the App Store for a free trial and start enjoying that Llama Life for yourself.